The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hello and welcome to Short Circuit, your usually bi-weekly podcast on the Federal Courts of Appeal. I'm your host, John Ross, joined this week by IJ attorneys Paul Sherman and Ricard Poach Kanawala. This week on the show, suspending indigent people's driver's licenses, standing to challenge a civil forfeiture, and a wayward cop's sign ban. Ricard, kick us off.
This case, Robinson versus Perkey. David Perkey is the commissioner of the Tennessee commissioner of the Department of Safety. It's from the Middle District, the Federal District Court for the Middle District of Tennessee. And the case is about plaintiffs whose driving licenses were suspended because they did not pay their traffic debt, which is the traffic fine, as well as other costs that associated with it, in full. And the reason they didn't pay in full is because they couldn't afford to pay. Tennessee law, like many other states, authorizes the state, the commissioner of safety, to suspend a driving license if the holder is convicted of a driving offense and doesn't pay the fine in full, as well as court fees and other fees, or fails to appear in court. In this case, the plaintiffs did not pay the fine and fees because of their indigency. They were unable to pay, and so their licenses were suspended. And the case arises on a motion, the plaintiff's motion, to compel the state to restore their driving license.
Yeah, and the facts of the individual plaintiffs, I think, are really pretty moving. I mean, these are folks who are really, really harmed by having their driver's license suspended. One of the plaintiffs in the case has severe liver disease and has to travel 30 miles to see his doctor without a car. He cannot reliably get to that doctor. The other is a single mother of five children who lost her job because she could not reliably make it to her minimum wage waitressing job. So the burden that this suspension imposes on them is just enormous.
That's exactly right. And to give you some idea as to what we're talking about here, the total fines for one of the plaintiffs was $441 in addition to a $323 reinstatement fee, a fee just to get their license restored.
And what was that for? Was that for a speeding ticket? $400 for a speeding ticket?
It was for a speeding ticket as well as failure to carry automobile insurance. And the other plaintiff had almost $500 in debt. And the last job that she was working at, which, as Paul mentioned, she was unable to continue at that job because of her driving privileges being taken away, she was earning just over $2 an hour. To give you some idea of the scale of this debt for people in this position.
So the state's justification for taking away the licenses because they didn't pay the fees is to encourage people to pay fees, right?
Yeah, and so luckily they end up before a pretty engaged judge who doesn't just take that at face value and actually says, is this a rational way of trying to get people to repay their fines and fees. And he says that even if in the abstract it might be, it's certainly not when you apply it to indigent people because there's no amount of punishment that can make people pay money that they simply don't have. And so ultimately the judge decides under the rational basis standard, which is the most permissive standard of constitutional review, that this policy is likely unconstitutional, and he grants the temporary restraining order.
A quick point of order, it's actually a female judge, and her order means that the plaintiffs get their licenses back, right, Ricard?
That's correct, as well as anyone in the plaintiff class similarly situated to these representative plaintiffs also get their licenses back. So on the rational basis point, the court looks at the actual justifications offered by the state in detail and rejects each one of them as either being irrelevant or, in fact, contrary to the state's legitimate purpose of getting people, the plaintiffs, to pay the fines and fees that they owe.
I think the actual line was it's affirmatively destructive to take away people's cars when they're trying to get to a job. it's affirmatively destructive of their ability to pay a fee.
Right. That taking an individual's driver's license away to try to make her more likely to pay a fine is not using a shotgun to do the job of a rifle. It is using a shotgun to treat a broken arm. There's no rational basis for that. That's the court's bottom line on that. But even when you take some of the state's justifications, like the public safety one, when you this judge does a great job of looking at it in detail and then dismissing it. For instance, the safety, the public safety is no better off by the fact that someone is able to pay their fines and fees and therefore gets their license back right away compared to someone else who may be as safe or safer driver, but because they're unable to pay their fines and fees, they don't get their license back. And the judge does a great job of looking at those justifications and dismissing them, as well as pointing out the necessity in Tennessee of having a license in order to hold a job and be able to pay.
Yeah, to me, one of the really interesting things about this case is I think it points out the artificiality of the distinction that federal courts have drawn between so-called fundamental rights and so-called non-fundamental rights, because I guarantee you for these two plaintiffs, they consider the right to have a driver's license far more fundamental and important than the right to engage in political speech or something else that the courts have held is fundamental and therefore entitled to higher protection.
I think that's exactly right. And it's great that this judge was engaged enough to actually apply the rational basis test in a way that seriously looked at the state's justifications and realized that there was nothing behind the facade. If another judge, the plaintiffs may not have been so lucky with another judge, and I think that's a critical point here.
What does the court say about a potential situation where someone says, "Hey, I'm indigent. Because of this ruling, I now no longer am going to have to pay traffic fines, so I'm going to speed." Is that a reasonable concern? Did the state bring that up? What does the court say about that?
Well, one of the things the court says to address that is that there's no real connection between making people pay their fines and fees and public safety, as we talked about, but also that they can use other collection means, of collecting the traffic debt.
So part of the plaintiff's problem here was that they were being asked to pay huge sums of money for them right off the bat, not on a payment plan. So a payment plan could be one option.
Right. And the state tries to bring that up by saying, "Oh, the law allows courts to offer a payment plan." But again, the judge is on the ball here and says, "Well, just because the law offers it or authorizes it doesn't mean that courts are mandated to take into account a plaintiff's ability to pay, hold a hearing, which is the other part of the case that the plaintiffs bring, that their 14th Amendment procedural due process rights have been violated because they weren't afforded an opportunity to have a hearing where they could bring evidence of their inability to pay and have that be taken into account. So the fact that a court technically can offer a payment plan is no help to these plaintiffs where they weren't offered one.
What happens next in this case?
Well, so the next step is going to be to move forward on the merits. There's going to be discovery and perhaps the temporary restraining order will be converted into a preliminary injunction. If it is, the case will go forward and ultimately the court will decide whether this system is constitutional or not. But this is an important first round victory for the plaintiffs because the court has already determined that it is overwhelmingly likely that the system is unconstitutional.
And that's a super important ruling, obviously, on the due process arguments. In addition, the plaintiffs bring an equal protection claim, and the court finds that there's some likelihood of success on that too, because the Tennessee law provides no exceptions or accommodations for people to people to hold assets that the state is trying to collect on. So technically under this law, a plaintiff has or a person whose license is suspended has to provide everything that they own to the state in order to pay their traffic debt.
Okay, let's move on to the next case. Paul.
So this case arises out of the Sixth Circuit, and it is called United States of America versus $31,000 in U.S. currency. So you know from the name alone that this is one of those civil forfeiture cases where instead of the government suing people, the government is suing property. And this is a pretty classic airport interdiction case involving two gentlemen named Taiwan Wiggins and Delonte Allison, who are going through the airport. And the factual description of what happened to them varies pretty wildly depending on whether you listen to the government's account or you listen to their account. The government says that after they went through security, they were approached by DEA agents, that they voluntarily entered into conversations with those agents, that they voluntarily allowed their bags to be searched, and that the DEA agents found $31,000 in one of their bags and $10,000 in the other of their bags. Mr. Wiggins and Mr. Allison argued that none of this interaction was voluntary, that the searches were not voluntary. And so the government tries to forfeit the money. Mr. Wiggins and Mr. Allison file as claimants to try and get the money back. And the government says, you don't have standing to try and get this money back.
And the district court buys it.
The district court does buy it. So the court explains that there's two kinds of standing in these cases. Constitutional Article 3 standing, which isn't at issue here, and then statutory standing under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure G, Rule 5G. And so this case is ostensibly about whether, as a matter of statutory procedure, just at the pleading stage, a claimant to the property at issue must provide details as to his claim of ownership. The district court rules in favor of the government that a claimant can't satisfy the rule without providing specifics, and the court here says no.
Yeah, so what happened here is the two claimants file their claim with the court, and they said, here's who we are, and they said, we owned this money. And the government's position is that's not enough. You have to give us some amount of detail that explains how you came to own the money. And they put forward a couple different justifications for this, but mostly they're all just policy arguments that are essentially the government will have an easier time in its forfeiture procedures, and the discovery process will be easier and more focused if we impose this heightened pleading standard. But the Sixth Circuit was having none of it.
Exactly. And the Sixth Circuit points out towards the end of the decision that this is really the government trying to shift its burden, which is already not the highest of burdens. It's a preponderance of the evidence burden to show that the property at issue is forfeitable, onto the claimants to show that it's not forfeitable. So there's this underlying burden shifting that's going on in the case, and the Sixth Circuit correctly, based on the opinion here, points out that that's impermissible. The text of the rule of civil procedure doesn't require it. There is a separate verification requirement that gets at the government's policy argument. So against false claims being made by people who may not actually have ownership rights to the property. So that policy argument is addressed by a different aspect of the rule not at issue here. And the court's pointing out that if there should be a further check, that really has to come from the legislature, from Congress.
What's the main takeaway of this case?
And this is an important procedural victory for claimants in civil forfeiture cases. Now, it doesn't mean that these guys are going to go on to win at the merits. It's a little suspicious that they had, you know, $31,000 and $10,000. And if the government's claims about how the interaction with them went down, you know, it's kind of fishy. And maybe these are drug proceeds that are subject to forfeiture. But the important thing is that these guys are going to get their day in court, and the government tried to deny them that. And crucially, the Sixth Circuit did not let the government get away with it.
And that's important, because the next kind of case in this area that comes up may not be involving such suspicious facts, and could involve far more innocent, or at least more innocent seeming claimants. And that's why it's important that the government be held to its evidentiary burden, particularly at this early stage.
So an engaged decision from the Sixth Circuit. Let's move on to the final case out of the Seventh Circuit, Ricard.
This case, Luce versus Town of Campbell, is a Seventh Circuit case, and it involves regulations that a town in Wisconsin, Campbell, passed regulating time, place, and manner of speech. And what the regulation said was that signs, banners, flags could not be hung over an overpass, or the three overpasses in the town limits.
So there's a highway that goes through the town, but it's three overpasses, and
exactly.
So you can't have protests
exactly.
up there.
So you can't have signs hanging over any of those within the town limits, and also that there cannot be any signs of any size or description within 100 feet of either end of any of those three overpasses.
Yep.
So those are the regulations at issue.
The facts giving rise to this case are pretty interesting and a little bit salacious. So a couple of guys who were involved with a local Tea Party organization decided they wanted to advertise their views, and they started putting banners on the overpasses with messages like "honk to impeach Obama." And this leads them to pass this ordinance. So when the city starts enforcing the ordinance, these guys videotape, you know, the signs being taken down, and they put them up on Facebook, which enrages the local sheriff the local chief of police, who retaliates against these guys by signing them up for like pornographic and gay websites. And so this lawsuit involves a couple of different claims. One is a challenge to the sign ban, and the other is a claim actually against this chief of police for retaliating against them for exercising their First Amendment rights.
And not only that, but the sign ban was basically at the chief of police's behest, was it not?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's where the chief of police's bad conduct sort of comes into play in the court's legal analysis. So the court ultimately holds that the claims against the chief of police can't go forward. What he did may have violated some state law, and maybe there are state law remedies, and he was also charged with a crime and convicted of a crime for what he did. But they do call into question the chief of police's credibility. It seems like he was just really mad at these guys. And so his factual claims about the need for this law and the effect of this law seem really dubious. And so the court considers that in its constitutional analysis.
And that question, and that raises the question of whether other evidence is required to support the time, place, and manner restrictions on speech that's at the heart of the law. And the court looks at that issue and says that the Supreme Court's never stated as a rule that evidence is required to justify such such restrictions, but there does need to be a good reason for such restrictions. The court here gives the example of regulating a megaphone in Times Square versus Central Park. The noise level in Times Square would be so high that really one would need a megaphone to be heard, and therefore a regulation banning such a manner of communicating would be suspicious in that circumstance, but not if it was in the context of a park like Central Park. So the court's making the point that it's not so much that specific evidence is required in the record to justify these regulations, but that there has to be some inference available to the court. And in this case, the court says, well, there is such an inference, because having banners over a highway would inherently mean that there are going to be some drivers who would slow down to look at the sign or read it or stop and take pictures of it. And that slowing down and change of speed could in fact cause accidents. And that could be something the town wants to avoid.
Yeah. Now, but the court is very careful, I think, to distinguish time, manner, and place cases like this one, where there is a lower standard of review, from cases involving content-based restrictions on speech. And so if the law only targeted banners that are critical of President Obama, that would be a classic content-based restriction, and the government would have to come for what? Well, I mean, as a practical matter, that would just be per se unconstitutional. But under strict scrutiny, the government would have to come forward with some kind of serious, meaningful evidence. You know, I feel sort of conflicted about this case because on the one hand, it does seem obvious and common sense that banners like this could pose some kind of traffic hazard. You know, on the other hand, the Supreme Court actually has said that you can't just rely on speculation and conjecture and that common sense isn't enough. And it seems like it wouldn't be hard for the government to come up with some kind of meaningful evidence to support this ban if it really needed to. So it doesn't seem like it would impose that much of a burden on the government.
The court does reference some studies that have shown that this change in speed from the median speed on a highway does increase the likelihood of accidents. Now, it also points out that there are other studies that go the other way that show that, that such a change in speed doesn't increase the risk of accident. So there may be some mixed record on that, but the court points out that when you clearly do not have a content driven restriction, that it is content neutral, then it's not up to it, and the court doesn't really have to weigh the factual record or the evidentiary record on the issue, and the mere fact that there is something to suggest that the town has a speech content neutral motive in mind in regulating the speech, that should be enough to uphold it in this case.
Now, you know, luckily though, the court, when it says you have to have a good reason, means that it takes that requirement seriously, because the court, although it upholds the restriction as applied to the overpasses, it then separately examines the restriction that extends 100 feet away from the overpasses, and it says, well, there's no good reason for this. I mean, we can't even imagine. It's ridiculously overbroad. You know, we don't require time, manner, and place laws to be perfectly tailored, but they can't sweep unnecessarily broadly. And
for instance, this makes it illegal for, you know, if you have a house next to the overpass, you can't put a for sale sign in front of your house, that there's no chance that someone on the highway would be distracted by.
Yeah, exactly. And the court says there's no justification for that, and the court strikes it down. So, you know, it's a kind of a mixed bag for the plaintiffs, but overall, I think a decent First Amendment ruling, and it shows that the court was taking the time, manner, and place standard at least significantly seriously.
I think that's right, and that the case does show that there is some teeth to the review of time, manner, and place restrictions, and in fact the town didn't even attempt to try and justify the ban on signs 100 feet from either side of the overpass. So I think that one was clearly out of bounds.
Okay, so no more signs on the overpass. But overall, three engaged decisions today. Okay, that concludes the show. Thanks for listening, and be sure to send any comments and questions to shortcircuit@ij.org. Until next time, this is John Ross from the Institute for Justice, strong-arming you to get engaged.